Thanks for listening to this Arrow FM podcast, shared on accessmedia.nz with the support of New Zealand On Air.
Hi folks, this is Richard here from Stonehenge Aotearoa, and also Kay. Hello Kay.
Hello.
And of course, as usual, we've got that other bloke with us as well. Which is, oh yeah, it's Keith, isn't it?
Hello there, folks.
Hello Keith. We've got a little bit of a, oh, I should always say like a, thanks Dan Broughton for sponsoring this show. We've got a bit of a smorgasbord of things we're going to look at that have been happening in the sky. We've got a comet, of course, some of you may have heard about that. We've got aurora, and we're also going to be looking at radio astronomy as well. So we'll get into it straight away. Okay, first of all, let's talk about the comet, all right? This is Comet Atlas. I'm not going to try and say the other name. Anybody else want to have a go?
No, I haven't heard it spoken.
As I said, it was discovered in 2023, and up until recently it's been something that could be seen in our morning sky, but as it's travelled around the sun, it's now moving into our evening sky, all right? Their closest approach occurred on Saturday, on the 11th. Close approach was 44 million kilometres from the Earth, all right? So that's the closest approach to the Earth. And then it's from then it's moved into our evening sky. And a little star, rotating star shows you that it's actually in the constellation of Virgo at the moment as it's rising up. But of course, a comet, because it's moving all the time, its position is continually changing in the sky. Okay? Now, its orbit, it's got an orbital period of 80,000 years. Okay? So I want you to think about that. The last time it was here was 80,000 years ago, and if you'd miss it now, you're going to have to wait another 80,000 years before you got a chance of seeing it again. Right. And last time it was around, the people looking at it would have been the Neanderthal people, Neanderthals, okay, 80,000 years ago.
And they wouldn't have had telescopes or anything to make proper observations either, would they?
Well, what they would have had is nice clear skies, wouldn't they?
Yes, that's the point.
No light pollution in those days.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so I thought just briefly explain it, but it's got this comet's actually got a diameter, the physical body's got a diameter of 3.2 kilometres. That's big, but it's pretty small as far as celestial objects go, right? So it's like a gigantic rock of ice and so on, travelling through space. And I just want a little picture of what it would probably look like, the nucleus. And what happens as this cometary-like object approaches the sun's radiation begins to evaporate the outer layers, and a halo begins to form around the comet, right? And this halo, while the comet's piece itself is only about 3 kilometres in diameter, the halo itself can be, you know, thousands of kilometres across, right? And then as it's travelling towards the sun, the solar radiation, particularly the solar wind, begins to drive the comet's tail backwards, right? So that's an important thing to remember, is that a comet's tail always points away from the sun, right? So when you look at this photograph, for example, you're looking at, this is another comet, Comet West, you're looking at here. It looks as if it's travelling towards the lower left of your screen. Actually, it could be travelling in the opposite, directly opposite direction, okay?
Yes. It's because of the solar wind blowing outward from the sun in all directions.
Yeah.
So it always points away from the sun, no matter what the direction the comet is actually travelling in.
Yeah.
Yes.
And also, the other thing, it's actually quite noticeable when you get a big bright comet, because they vary. I mean, sometimes they're quite faint, but every now and again we get a brilliant comet in the sky. Is that they've got two different types of tail. And if you look on this photograph, on this one, you can see like a yellow tail and a blue tail, okay?
Yeah.
Well, the two, the, actually, the blue tail is gas coming away from the thing. And it tends
to... nucleus.
Yeah. Yes. And then the other one is dust particles that are blasted from it. But the thing is that what it's doing is leaving particles behind, right? I think I've got... Here's a lovely photograph of another comet. And you can see as it's gone around the sun, which is below the horizon here, over time, how its tail has been left behind. This is material that's been left behind by the comet, blasted from its surface and left out there in space.
Mm.
And then, of course, what happens is, with a bit of luck, what happens every now and again, we pass through that debris left behind and we get a meteor shower, or sometimes right in the centre we can get a meteor storm, right?
Yes.
And these can be pretty spectacular, but of course they only last for a short period of time as the Earth's travelling through that, right?
So we get the meteor swarm as an after effect of the comet as we go through the tail.
Yeah, if we travel through it, depends where the tail of the comet is and that path of the comet is. But if it's crossing the orbit of the Earth, then we will get...
But sometimes it's not the actual tail you see. Sometimes it's a clump it leaves behind, and it's, as it goes around, a little denser clump.
Yeah. Well, that's right. Mm. So good to remember a comet, every time it comes around, it's losing mass, so it's gradually getting smaller and smaller as time goes on.
So the debris that it leaves behind is not evenly spread. You get the odd sort of... cluster of bits.
And what I can tell you, if you see a meteor shower, it's pretty spectacular. In fact, we're quite used to getting people phoning up and worrying because of what's happening, you know.
Nuclear attack.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
It looks like a whole lot of missiles falling down from the sky.
So where do these comets come from? Well, we think of the solar system as just ending at Pluto, where the planets are. I've just put a diagram up showing you Neptune, the outermost big planet, and also Pluto there. And surrounding the solar system, in the plane of the solar system, is something called the Kuiper Belt. Now, we now believe that this Kuiper Belt, which is made up of lots of icy bodies, is actually the relic of what's left over when the solar system was formed, and never formed into planets. But the Kuiper Belt is only part of it, because the Kuiper Belt in turn is surrounded by the Oort cloud. I'll bring that up now. So as you can see, it's our solar system is actually a lot larger than it initially looks. That Oort cloud could go at least half a light year or something like that.
Yes. It's considerably bigger than the solar system itself, yes.
And what we do know from this comet is that it's come from the Oort cloud. So it's now on its way back out there into the depths of space. Yeah.
And that, by the way, explains why it's got a period of 80,000 years.
Yeah.
Because it's sweeping past the sun, and then it's going to go all the way back out to the Oort cloud, way, way beyond the orbit of Pluto, and pass a light year out, and then swing back round and come back.
This is periodically going to happen with different comets as they get swept in. And of course, what actually also can happen, when a comet comes close in down towards the sun, it can pass too close to a giant planet like Jupiter or Saturn, which in turn can alter its orbit. It can alter its orbit by flinging it right out again, but sometimes its orbit becomes smaller. So you've got Halley's Comet, which I think returns every 76 years or something like that.
76 years, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
But it never used to have that. It would have had, just like this comet, an orbit measured in thousands of years. But what's happened, it's gradually slowed down.
It had the interaction with Jupiter, and the gravity altered the trajectory.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Of course, there can also be a little bit worrying, because there's always the possibility of a comet, because when they come in, could be on collide with the Earth. And on occasions this does happen, right? And we know this happened about 60-odd million years ago, right? Fortunately, it's not that common. And when that occurs, it causes a mass extinction, because it's not just the comet nucleus is small, it's the velocity at which it's moving. And as that thing hits the Earth's atmosphere and then the surface of the Earth, it releases more energy than the entire nuclear arsenals of this world. Right? So it can be pretty catastrophic.
Some of those comets actually explode before they hit, if you know what I mean. They explode, and they think that happened in Tugasta, where they absolutely flattened large amounts of trees and things like that, and actually evidently shifted whole reindeer herds from one place to another.
Well, knowing that these things can happen, of course, in the past, we could just, all we could do is worry about it. It might probably almost certainly not going to happen in our lifetime, but we never know when the next one's going to hit the earth. But of course, we're actually in a position now when we can do something about it. And what NASA is doing, for example, is every comet, it precisely works out its path. And using things like the Hubble Space Telescope, James Webb's telescope, they're hunting down for these cometary bodies so they can work at their orbits. So in the event that it looks like in the future it's good, there's going to be a collision, they can do something about it. The idea is that we can go out and nuke it or something like that.
Yes, they call them near-Earth or objects, don't they?
Mm, yeah.
Anything that's going to come.
That's right. So that's what NASA is actually trying to do with something, is to work out anything like this so we can stop any future mass extinction.
Or work out how close it's coming.
That's right. But of course, you've got to remember, when they're any distance away, they're quite faint, you know?
Yeah, well, especially the asteroid ones that aren't comets. Comets at least light up to show you they're there.
When they get closer, but if you're looking at something beyond the orbit of Pluto, I mean,
you can't see it.
You're not going to see it at all, are you? You know?
No.
Yeah, it's going to be a bit of a problem. Yeah. Okay. Well, I wanted to talk about seeing the universe. I thought seeing the universe. Well, we see it through radiation. Okay, and we see what we call visible light. And of course, as you may know, that visible light can be broken up into different colours, red through to violet and blue.
Colours of the rainbow.
And those colours are simply due to the different wavelengths, the speed, the wavelengths of the different light particles. So violet is far more energetic than red light is, and so on. But what I must point out to you, and everything we look, when we look at a beautiful picture of scenery, that some things are, for example, grass is obviously radiating a lot more of the green light that's coming down than its other wavelengths, so we see it as green and so on. And when we look at all the beautiful colours we see on our planets and so on, this is all to do with that spectrum. But what I'd like to point out to you is that when we're looking at this, we're only looking at a tiny, small percentage of that massive massive radiation. And there are, for those of you watching it on TV, I've brought this up and showing you the wavelengths of the... You can see where visible light falls in, right? And then shorter wavelengths above the visible blue light we've got is ultraviolet radiation, X radiation above that, and then gamma rays. All right, all of these are dangerous. UV, of course, as you all know, burns you. X rays, well, they can travel through you, but if you had too many X rays, they soon kill you.
One thing with electromagnetic radiation is that the higher the frequency, the more impact, the more energy radiation has, and this is why X-rays have enough power to go right through the human body and show up the structures inside.
And indeed, many things that great discoveries that we've made out in the universe have not been invisible light. Suddenly, radio astronomers or something has picked up an X radiation coming from a certain point in the sky.
Black hole.
Something there. Then above a longer wavelength, of course, you've got infrared radiation, which is heat. Microwaves, and then radio waves at the top. Right? Yeah. So in the universe, we've got this whole great pageant of different wavelengths. But of course, in human beings, because we've evolved on planet Earth, we can only see this narrow wave band of light, which is useful to us because normally we can't X-ray, even if you could see them, X-rays don't come through the atmosphere.
Some people can see slightly outside that band, very, very slightly, but they can.
Yeah. Yeah. We always assume we're seeing the same things, don't we? Maybe we're not.
I know my brother wanted to be bringing planes in, and he couldn't because he couldn't be accepted because he could see outside the normal range.
Is that right?
And that would confuse him.
Anyway, I'm going to hand over to Keith now because Keith is a little bit of expert on radio astronomy.
Well, as Richard pointed out, there's an awful lot more to the universe than what we see with our eyes. I'm a musician. I play the piano, and I sometimes think of all the beautiful colours that we see, as being able to see the universe with ears, as it were, tuned to just middle C on the keyboard and the key above that. And there's all the other notes on either side. And we don't see those, but we now have equipment which can pick those up. We're used to astronomy, as a result, we're used to astronomy consisting of telescopes with lenses and mirrors and giving us amazing optical images of the universe. But one very important tool that we have nowadays is radio astronomy. This is basic. Radio astronomy is basically exactly the same thing, except we're looking at the universe in radio waves rather than optical visible light. What you're looking at the moment, for those of you on TV, is the famous Parkes dish in Western Australia. And this was the dish, by the way, that was used during the Apollo 11 moon landing to transmit the images of the moon landing back to Earth. But its primary purpose is to observe the universe, the cosmos, in radio waves. This is the control room, and you can see, very different from an optical telescope, radio telescopes consist of masses and masses of electronic equipment and all this sort of thing. Basically, how do they work? The dish on top of the building is nothing more than a huge radio antenna, an absolutely massive radio antenna. And it picks up radio waves, brings them to a focus, and then sends them down to all the equipment you can see there, amplifiers and computers and so forth. So you don't look through a radio telescope and you don't actually listen to a radio telescope. Instead, you print it out on a computer screen. One of the, as an example of the sorts of things that radio telescopes can see, these are supernova remnants in the Milky Way galaxy. Each pink area you can see there is a supernova remnant. This is viewed by the Parkes radio telescope. Now, you can't see all of these with an optical telescope because there's too much in the way of clouds and dust and so forth blocking everything. But radio waves can still get through. So this is the sort of astronomy you can do using radio astronomy. Started off in the early 30s, this is Carl Jansky. He was an American, he wasn't an astronomer, he was actually a telephone engineer employed by Bell Laboratories in the States. And they were trying, the telephone company back then, they were trying to figure out why shortwave radio transmissions had so much noise. If they could get rid of that noise, then they could use shortwave to get telephone conversations across the world. And they employed Jansky, who was a young graduate student, to try and figure out where all this noise, this static, was coming from. And so he built this telescope in 1933. It doesn't look much like a radio telescope as we know it today. It had the wheels off a Model T Ford motor car. It looks basically like a gigantic clothesline. But essentially, he did some amazing research with it. He discovered three types of noise: crashing noises from nearby thunderstorms, clicks from faraway thunderstorms, and steady, mysterious hiss that he realized was coming from somewhere in outer space. A few years later, we meet up with this gentleman, Grote Reber, who's an American radio enthusiast. He was very much into shortwave. He heard about Jansky's work and this mysterious hiss, and he decided to build a better radio telescope. You can see it on the left there. It looks more like what you'd expect an RT to look like. Now, it's a dish with suspended above it a great big box which contains all the electronics needed to receive the radio information. And he was the one who realised this mysterious hiss was actually coming from the centre of our own Milky Way galaxy. This is a radio map that he produced. It's actually a little bit further north in the sky. But he discovered this hiss was coming from the direction of Sagittarius. And if, as any astronomer knows, Sagittarius is the direction of the centre of our Milky Way galaxy. So Grote Reber had discovered the centre of the Milky Way galaxy in radio waves. It's a rather crude-looking image, but if you compare it with the modern image now, which was produced in 2015, you can see just how detailed a map of the Milky Way galaxy can be. We can even see some of the extragalactic sources. We can see the nucleus of the galaxy. We can also see some of the strange and wonderful radio emissions in our own galaxy. This is an image of M87, which is a giant elliptical galaxy in the constellation of Virgo. And what you're looking at is quite breathtaking. This is the event horizon around a black hole, the black hole at the centre of this galaxy. And this was taken not with an optical telescope, but again with a radio telescope. In fact, it was taken with 28 radio telescopes all joined together. We're going to visit that at the moment. This is a sort of thing that you can do with modern radio telescopes. We have a look at a couple of dishes. This is the Greenback Telescope in West Virginia, one of the biggest radio telescopes. And this one is the one that Rich is probably most familiar with, the Jodrell Bank, the Lovell Telescope at Jodrell Bank in England. And Jodrell Bank has quite an amazing history. I haven't got time to go into it, but the way it was built and part of the reasons why it was built, it's still one of the world's largest steerable radio telescopes. But once again, you can see how it works. You've got the great big dish behind collecting the radio information from the sky, and at the centre, suspended at the, what they call the focus, is the box where all the electronic equipment gathers the radio information. And then we come back to the VLA, the Very Large Array in Socorro, New Mexico. There are 28 of these amazing dishes, and if you ever watch the movie Cosmos, Contact, you'll probably recognise these as being the ones that picked up extraterrestrial information.
Well, some of them are looking for that sort of thing, aren't they?
Exactly, they're doing that right now. Jodie Foster starred in that movie. Yeah, with 28 radio telescopes, they can move them all around on railway tracks and point them in various directions. So they can actually act as what's called an interferometer. All those dishes are connected together so carefully that they actually reinforce each other's image. And so you get a very, very detailed image. And that's how they got that image of the black hole in M87 that we saw earlier on. This is another one that was imaged by the VLA. This is HL Tauri, and what you're looking at is a solar system being born. It's a planetary disk with gaps where the possibly where planets are actually being formed. And once again, you're looking at this not in optical but in radio waves. Another spectacular image is the Zeta of UK molecular clouds. That looks like the part of the centre of the clouds. And once again, you're looking at these in radio waves. We mentioned the search for extraterrestrial intelligence using the VLA. One use of radio telescopes is to actually look for extraterrestrial intelligence. For a long time, astronomers didn't really want anything to do with this. But now I think we're starting to come round to that. Mm-hmm. Would that be right, Richard?
Yep, absolutely.
We come around to thinking, hey, there might be something in this after all. And the best way is to listen for radio transmissions from other civilizations.
I think in the near future we can do a program just about that development of intelligent life out there.
So we look at all these. This is a map that I made quite some time ago of our part of the Milky Way galaxy. And I sometimes think out there, there are stars with planets, with Earth-like planets, and those planets are radiating their version of Netflix and Coral Street and music and that. And if we build a sensitive enough radio telescope, we might be able to pick them up. Mm-hmm. So there you go.
That's right, yeah. As well as I said, there's only two possibilities. Either we're alone or we're not. Both are equally terrifying. Yes. We'll go into that in more detail later on. Yeah. Anyway, folks, just showing this radio astronomy is another complete realm of things that you cannot see, but which is, with modern technology, has given us new eyes to look at things in the universe. Mm. The other thing, of course, that people have been seeing lately is aurora on the sky. There's a beautiful photograph of an aurora there. This is all down to solar activity. The sun goes for an 11-year cycle, and it's getting pretty active now. And every now and again, we get mighty explosions near the surface of the sun, and radiation, which is normally trapped and comes back to the surface by its magnetic fields, blasts outwards and streams out into space. And if the Earth happens to be in the path of that, this stuff comes and hits the Earth. Right? Mm. And then what will happen is, that we are protected from deadly radiation, these particles, by the magnetic field of the sun. So that magnetic field around us is all important. If without that, deadly radiation would reach the surface of the Earth.
Life wouldn't exist.
No. But on a big explosion of the sun, if we get struck by one of these, what we call a solar flare, what happens is that the magnetic field of the Earth gets pushed over. And as that happens, or just before that, radiation begins to seep down near the polar regions, all right? And that's when we see the aurora. So they look beautiful, but actually under nuclear attack when you see that.
Yes,
occurring.
They are quite deadly,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And indeed, folks, you will find that the incidence of skin cancer amongst human beings rises and falls with the solar cycle, right?
Yes.
So we're entering into it. So make sure this summer, when we get nice weather, is you put that sun cream on, right, to protect yourself.
I did look out for the aurora the other night, Richard, but there was all this wet stuff falling out of the sky. So, too many clouds. So,
yeah.
Yes.
Well, it's like looking for that comet. I haven't seen the comet yet, because every time I've gone out, the sky has been cloud. Go out in the evening sky now and have a look towards the west at sundown, all right, and see if you can pick it up. Okay. So that's, and also keep an eye out for the aurora. Now, what I can tell you, it's just isn't there all the time. I've seen an aurora. When you see one, it's an awesome event. It's everything is moving, all these colours. And I saw a brilliant one here from the Wairarapa, but it lasted for about 20 minutes and then it stopped, it's gone.
Yeah.
So unless you were out at that moment in time, you simply wouldn't see it, you know. Yeah. Okay. Well, we're just about to pack up now. Just to remind you that Stonehenge, we're open from Wednesday to Sunday at the moment, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Closed on Mondays and Tuesdays, except for private bookings.
Please check the web page.
Yeah.
Because if something comes up and we have to close for some unusual event, either personal or with a Henge, we will do our very best to get it up on the web page.
That's right, yeah.
So do check the web page.
Absolutely.
For any notices.
Because particularly if anyone's coming from Wellington or something like that, the weather could be great in Wellington, atrocious out here. So do check that out.
Or the other way around.
Yeah, yeah. And we also got Star Treks, which we run in the evenings as well. But they have to be booked, don't they, Kay?
Yes, these are what they call naked eye. In other words, we're not using telescopes for these. We're using... We show you wonderful things that you can see inside the theatre, and then we are looking and using our eyes and teaching you how to find your way around.
That's right. So Star Trek's we've got, and with that, we're just got about to wind up. All right, we've got the tours and things like that you can do there. But just be bear in mind, you think the night sky is the same. I think probably from what you've seen tonight, what we've just been talking about, it's changing all the time. There's new discoveries, new things to see and discover. Anyway, yes. Having said that, I'm going to wind up now. Bye, folks.